Chapter 3. The First Investigators. And just a reminder here, our story has investigators and victims of the Golden State Killer describing violent crimes and sexual assaults. It may not be suitable for some listeners. As the number of East Area rapist attacks grew, so did pressure on law enforcement to catch him. No one felt that pressure more than Sacramento County Sheriff's Department detectives Richard Shelby and Carol Daly, and over in Contra Costa County, Detective Larry Crompton.
I'm Carol Daly.
Everybody was talking about the East Area rapist. Why haven't you got him? You know, what are you guys doing? They wanted this guy caught.
I think the final straw was walking into the office one day, getting on the elevator to go up to my third floor office, and one of the deputies came by and he just said, "Haven't you guys caught that creep yet?" And I thought, you know what, we did everything.
I'm Larry Crompton. It was very difficult to go through all the cases that we did and not catch the person. You can't get that out of your mind. It stays with you. The man wore a mask. He always wore gloves.
The victims never knew when he left, because he was back and forth. He would leave the room, and then they would start to move, and he'd come back in and say, "Don't move, don't move. I told you, don't move. I'm going to kill you." So they would lay there, sometimes an hour, afraid to move. And so by the time they were able to get loose and make a call and have anybody respond, he was long gone. And that was part of his plan of evading law enforcement, was making sure the victims never knew when he left the house.
There was a time in Sacramento when it felt safe to leave your doors unlocked, your shades up, and your windows open while your children ran around the neighborhood.
The community at the time, let me tell you, when I came into law enforcement in 1968, I worked Sundays. I had Friday and Saturday off, I think. I came in Sunday morning. I would get my case, whatever the guys, they got the big good cases, but we'd each get our case. Then we'd all go to breakfast, and we'd have breakfast. Then we'd go out, and I'd work my one case. And it was quiet. I meant the streets were quiet. It was calm in Sacramento. People would sleep outside in the backyard on their back porch. And, you know, our summers are cool at nighttime, but during the day it can be very hot. People rode bicycles. Kids played outside. You didn't worry about anything.
Margaret Wardlow, who became the 27th victim of the East Area rapist, remembers Sacramento as a safe and idyllic place to grow up.
Well, they always refer to Sacramento as a cow town, and it is still a bit of a small town in that everyone knows one another there. It was a place where you felt comfortable leaving a window open or letting your kids run loose. I went to a private school, but I came home considerably earlier than my mother would. She worked for the state of California. Jerry Brown was the governor at the time. And I would come home from school, grab my fishing pole. We lived right on the American River. I'd grab my dog, head down to the river. I had a raft. I'd take the raft out and go out in the water. And you were able to live your life pretty freely. I rode my bike everywhere. I had a big golden retriever that was very protective while he was in the house. So it was a great place to grow up, especially with the river. It was a beautiful place to live.
Jane Carson, the fifth victim of the East Area rapist, remembers when the case became public.
An executive of local media and the CEO of Livermore Laboratories, who had a daughter starting college at Sac State, actually went to the sheriff in Sacramento and confronted him. They had heard there was a serial rapist and told him to let the public know. So the sheriff agreed, and then he would report future rapes to the media. Had I known that he had broken into homes prior to coming back and assaulting women, then I would have had the alarm system on the home immediately, and I would have been aware that, you know, this is what he does. I thought because I had reported the rape, maybe he was going to come back and take revenge. Also, I had hang up phone calls at that time. He didn't say anything to me, as he did to other victims, but I knew it was him. People thought they knew his MO and what he was doing to other women, which was just not true. For instance, I went to a military wives club party at a private home where the conversation was, of course, on the East Area rapist, One woman said she had heard he was cutting off women's nipples. And of course I knew that wasn't true. I was his fifth victim, and I was quite aware of what he did. At that time, you know, only my immediate family and two best friends knew about my rape. So I wanted to stand up and scream at those women, "You have no idea. You don't know. You have no idea what happened." But I didn't want to own up to the fact that I had been raped. I didn't want it to be part of my identity. Back in the 70s, there was a lot of social stigma attached to this type of crime, and I was not about to expose myself.
The offender calling and hanging up on the victims after his attack serves two dark purposes. He's reliving his past attacks and continuing to torture his victims. This duality speaks to both his psychopathy and his intelligence. In the sunroom of Carol Daly's home on the west side of Sacramento, a long table is covered 3 inches deep with newspaper articles. They're about cases she worked during her extensive career as one of the only female detectives in Sacramento County.
So this is the dining room table that I set up to clear out four boxes of stuff that I had accumulated over my career. Photographs, newspaper clippings, books, articles, homicides that I've worked, rape cases that I've worked. All of these clippings here in the middle are all of the East Area Rape, all of the headlines, and I have even more. This was January 30th of 1978, and that was when he kicked in the front door. Here is the Sacramento Union, a couple terrorized by the East Area Rapist. This is East Area Rapist attacks, 20th victim. He's the talk of the town. Two victims recalled the East Area Rapist. That was May 22nd of 77. And then they always had a map showing where all of the rapes were.
A map of his attacks reveals an extensive web of unofficial Sacramento pathways. Miles of drainage culverts run behind fenced-in backyards. Tree-shrouded railroad tracks bisect dark, sleepy neighborhoods. A high levee protecting rows of townhomes from the flood-prone American River offers a view into second-floor windows. And unlit public parks run up against the wooden fences of single-story homes. At night, glowing windows reveal the patterns of life inside. Who's home and who's not? In 1976 and the first half of 1977, the East Area Rapist prowls and hunts exclusively on the east side of Sacramento. On any given day, as cars drive up and down the streets and sidewalks are busy with latchkey kids and dog walkers, the East Area Rapist is there too. But he's not catching anyone's attention. He blends in enough that at twilight, no one notices when he slips away between two houses.
I'm Anne Marie Schubert. I'm the district attorney of Sacramento County. There's no question that that case changed this community. And sometimes it's hard to explain to people if you didn't live through it. I know it because I lived through it. I mean, to this day, 40 plus years later, I have people come up to me and say, "Oh my God, my dad put tarps in the hallway because he wanted to know if he could hear someone coming down the hallway. Gun sales went up. Locks were sold out in stores. Women took defense classes." I come from a big family. There's seven kids in my family, and so I have three brothers and three sisters. Some of the things that some of my siblings have reminded me of is that my mom started to sleep with an ice pick under her pillow. One of my sisters was a babysitter for her. It was terrifying to be a babysitter. It was on the news all the time because it was happening. Sometimes it was every week. And so for me as a 12-year-old, in that time frame, it was not a matter of if it was going to happen again. It was a matter of when.
Margaret's idyllic childhood was marred by the East Area Rapist months before he ever attacked her. The city's feeling of safety and security had fractured, putting everyone, including Margaret, on alert.
Well, as soon as the sheriff's department announced that we had a serial rapist in our midst in Sacramento, guns were flying off the shelves. We had gangs of men that would go out in the evenings and drive around all night looking for this guy. I've talked to a number of people that had bells on doorknobs. I know my brother and a gang of his buddies would go down to the river and look for this guy. It was a frightening time in Sacramento. the sheriff's department was setting up roadblocks, and they would actually search people's cars. They went through their things, asked them what they were doing driving at this hour, or if they were on a paper route or something like that, on a bicycle, because this guy was notorious for jumping on a stolen bike and leaving the crime scene and then eventually somehow getting into his vehicle that was parked blocks away. It just got to be very discouraging after attack after attack after attack. They hadn't caught him yet.
On September 6, 1977, the East Area Rapist makes a change. Attack number 23 marks the first time he leaves his familiar hunting ground, spreading his terror south to the city of Stockton, 50 miles from Sacramento. At 1 a.m., he breaks the lock on a home's sliding glass patio door and creeps into the master bedroom, where he shines a flashlight into the eyes of a 27-year-old woman and her 31-year-old husband. "Don't move or I'll kill you," he says, and forces the wife to tie up her husband. Then the East Area Rapist sets a cup and saucer on the husband's back and tells him if the dishes rattle, he'll kill the wife. He takes her into the living room, rapes her twice, and ransacks the house. This is when the couple's 6-year-old daughter gets up to use the bathroom. She encounters the East Area Rapist in the hallway. He's wearing a ski mask, gloves, a belt with a long knife in it, and is naked from the waist down. He tells her, "I'm playing tricks with your mom and dad. Come watch me." At the time, a cross-jurisdictional competitive culture grew between the police forces that inhibited information sharing. This was unfortunate because by the time the East Area Rapist ended his reign of terror, he'd committed attacks in 7 counties.
Back in that time, departments didn't really communicate that much. And a lot of it was, this is our city and we handle our cases ourselves and we don't need your help. And it really hurt in a lot of cases because you couldn't get the information that you needed.
When he went into the city and raped right next to our own jurisdiction, our commander said, "You don't talk to them." They said, "You don't talk to us." If it weren't for the officers on the street sharing information, we might not have tied a lot of these cases together because everybody said, "You couldn't catch him, we can, ha ha ha." So when he moved to all of the other jurisdictions, there wasn't a lot of sharing.
One of the ones that really, really, really bothered me was the one in Walnut Creek. The first one that was hit there was June the 2nd of 1979. I got the call on that, and again, I was working in the crime lab, went over to it. It was a 17-year-old girl babysitting there. She was sitting at the kitchen table. And the screen door was closed, but the big door was open. She had the television on and doing her homework. And he broke in. There were 2 kids in the house. He didn't wake them up, but he did rape her. Like I said, she was 17 years old. I went over to Walnut Creek to the department and talked to the lieutenant and told him, I said, this is East Area Rapist. But this is not the person he was after, and he's going to hit you again. And I was told at that time, we handle our own cases. We don't need your help. We don't need your task force. I told him, I said, no, you have got to understand, this is not who he was after. He did not know that she was at that house. He just happened to be going by on his way to the person he was after. Again, I was told, we don't need your help. And I left. That stayed with me. June the 25th, he hit a 13-year-old, and that 13-year-old was the one that he was after to begin with. She had never had a boyfriend. She didn't know anything about sex. The way that he treated those 2 girls was the same way that he treated all the others before them. Tied them up, tied them tight, threatened to kill them. And I believe at that time that he would have if they hadn't gone along with exactly what he told him to do.
I get it every time. Was there something you could have done that you did not? And there was not. The things that we put our victims through, you can just imagine. People have no idea what rape victims go through. I always have my clothes laid out ready to jump into my clothes and be in the car and drive 90 miles an hour to get somewhere
And of course, you don't have traffic like you have now. But then I would go in. Our victim has already been raped. And so I'm taking her into the bedroom. And I said, look, we're going to try to collect some fingerprints. Tell me everywhere he touched you. A new technique had been developed where you pick up fingerprints off the body. And actually, they only last for a very short period of time. It's a process of iodine fuming. And you have a vial and you are heating it up and you're making it warmer. And then you blow and a smoke comes out and you iodine fume. And then they quit doing it because it was carcinogenic. So there was nothing that we didn't try to do at that time. Now, remember, in the 70s, we didn't have 911. There was not a number where somebody could call and get an answer right away. We didn't have cell phones. Officers on the street had to stop at restaurants or pay phones. We had to keep quarters with us, or nickels, I think, dimes at the time, to make phone calls.
The hysteria rapist was not the most active rapist in California at that time. In 1973 through 1976, they had one called the early morning rapist, and he committed 36 rapes and was never identified. Don't know where he went. The woolly rapist, he would count to 100 backwards and place them in a closet. The pillowcase rapist, and he attacked 54 women between 1976 and 1978. The San Diego rapist, he had 30 rapes. The stinky rapist in Berkeley, all the victims said that he had an odor. They just called him stinky. The car key rapist, one that would rape them in their car, and then he would take their car keys and run. There was probably 8-10 rapists that were active at that time, but they were not trying to kill people and not threatening to kill people. They were doing it for the sex. Hysteria rapist was doing it for the terror that he could put in their minds.
The hysteria rapist seemed to be reading the news about himself, and there was far more news about him than any other serial offender at the time. Sometimes the articles quoted the detectives who were chasing him. Would the hysteria rapist try to terrorize them too? How else do we explain what happened to Richard Shelby?
He was in the roof of our house that one night in May of 77. What had happened, our son woke us up. I remember that, and he was really scared. Saw a guy hang upside down. Him was a little, like a knit cap, a little ball hanging off the end. He had a little ball on the string, and it wiggled back and forth. That's how he saw it. The guy shined a flashlight across the bedroom once. He says he heard him on the roof, saw him do that, and he said he danced all around that roof like he wanted somebody to find him. No, I don't know who else would be. Yeah, I wondered, did he know whose house he was on top of when he was on my house? Probably did. I had an unmarked car sitting right there in the driveway. He could have been just screwing me. He could have wanted me to come out with a gun on me and do his thing.
There was no question that the East Area rapist was getting under the skin of law enforcement. And it wasn't just law enforcement. Everyone in the community looked at their neighbors differently. Everyone was a suspect. But it was those uniformed officers that had the task of checking out every tip they received. And along the way, they had some suspects that looked very promising.
In December 77, we chased a guy down the 1 Avenue wearing a ski mask. And they lost him. And you think, maybe that was East Area Rapist. They don't really know. But they found a bicycle.
We knew at the time that the East Area Rapist was a non-secretor.
An offender's secretor status is, well, maybe I'll let Paul Holes answer that one for you.
The secretor status is related to one's blood type in the ABO system. So most people are aware that they are either a blood type A or a blood type B or blood type O, etc. But there's a small percentage of the population that we call non-secretors. And even though their blood type will test for type A, you don't find their blood type in their saliva or their semen. It just comes up as negative.
So what we would do with people like this is trying to get them to chew on gauze, and we turn it in and find out if they were a non-secretor.
Detective Larry Crompton had a great suspect that they thought might be the East Area Rapist, but they couldn't get his blood type to find out whether he was a non-secretor.
I was with him several times, and he refused. And one time we even went to his mother's place to try and contact him, and she told us, stay away from him. If you want anything, you go through his attorney. I have an attorney for him, and stay away from him. So we stayed with it. And a couple more times, I was in contact with him. Then I was told by the sheriff, we had a restraining order against me, and I was supposed to stay away from him. That made it a little difficult. So I found out where he was staying with his girlfriend, and I said, we'll go talk to him. I got him out of the house and was talking to him, and he was yelling at me and said, I got a restraining order against you. You're not supposed to talk to me. And I told him, I said, look, I know you're not the rapist. I'm doing this to clear you. He continued to yell at me. So I asked my partner if he would go to the car for a while, let me talk to him. He did. And I told this person, I said, okay, now I know you've got dope in the house in there. I know it's your girlfriend's house. So when I call narcotics, she's going to go to prison and it's going to be your fault. So I'm going to ask you for the last time to chew on the gauze. I just want to clear you. And he said, well, if I chew on the gauze, are you going to call narcotics? And I said, no. I said, I don't care about the dope that you have in the house. All I want to do is eliminate you. I gave him the gauze and he chewed on it. And then I went back to the car and with my buddy, and he said, how in heck did you get him to do that? Well, I told him that I would call narcotics and they'd get the dope. You seen dope? And I said, no, but I know he was a dope smoker. So he knew he must have some in there. So I just told him I knew that he had it in there and I would call it on him. So we got the gauze, turned it in. He was a secretor. So that cleared him. Sometimes you go through more than what you should, but we did it. I went to the Vacaville Medical Center where they have prisoners, and I talked to a doctor there that works with the rapists that are in prison, and I gave her three reports, and she said, come back next week, and she said, I'll talk to my rapist, and we'll see what we can come up with. So I went back, and she said, you had better catch him. Said, he wants to kill. And she said, my rapist here said that he's given them a bad name. And I said, what? And she said, you got to understand who I deal with here. She said, they don't think they hurt people. But in going over these, they all agree that he is dangerous. He wants to kill. And she said, in my mind, he will not be taken. That he will kill you or he will kill himself.